Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success.
Please join Robert Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki in this season of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
Welcome back to the Culture and Sports Podcast. We have an incredible guest for you today, Professor Brandon Wright. He's an Associate Professor of Instruction at Ohio University. Brandon, how are you doing today?
I am doing very well, Dr. Piasecki. So how you doing?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you. Can you please give us a little bit about your background?
Absolutely, I can. So I come from the great state of Ohio. I wasn't born here, but I did grow up here. And was always interested in sports from a young age. Actually, an athlete myself, but also kind of the product of athletics. My father was a quarterback at Bowling Green State University. He met my mother there, who was the head cheerleader. I was the product of that marriage. My mother moved to Columbus after they split up. My dad was out of Pennsylvania at the time. So I grew up in Columbus, even though I'm originally from Pennsylvania. But much like my parents, was always interested in athletics, both on the playing side, but also on the consuming side. My particular sports that I excelled at in high school were football, basketball, and track and field. And track and field was the one sport that kind of helped me narrow my post high school graduation, where I was fortunate enough to run for the varsity athletic track and field team at the University of Cincinnati. I studied political science there because another one of my interests is government, and social studies was always a very interesting class for me, and all the classes underneath that subject umbrella. Enjoyed my 4 years at Cincinnati. I had a much better high school career as an athlete than I did as a college athlete. So I knew very early on, especially because I was running with professional athletes eventually as teammates, that I wasn't at that level, and I didn't necessarily want to put in the work to get to that level, that I was more interested in potentially pursuing a job outside of sports, as the NCAA loves to say. And for me, that was two options, kind of looking at the political structure of the United States and going down that path. And I wanted, after 4 years of learning, nothing to do with it. So much like many other political science or liberal arts degrees, I was like, oh, maybe I'll go to law school because I like government, I like politics, and I like helping people. And that was it for me. I went to Howard University School of Law out in Washington, D.C., which Washington obviously is the mecca of political activity within the country, and I got a chance to go to the actual, as we call it, the mecca of historically black colleges and universities at Howard. It is a institution that is very, very grounded in critical analysis of the social justice initiatives across the United States. It's the home of the first Supreme Court justice who's an African American. So there's a lot of charges in terms of your duties to society at a place like Howard, and exploration as to how you want to give back to society. For me, going to law school and learning that I didn't necessarily want to be in the courtroom, but thinking at the same time, how do I want to give back? My experience as an athlete in college and as an athlete overall was one by which I could clearly see a lens. There are people that are helping you figure out what you want to do and then putting you down the path and helping you along. So why not do the same for somebody else? I had an experience in college as an athlete where I really could see how many people were supporting me and the rest of my teammates, and I wanted to do that. So for me, I was trying to figure out a way to marry my legal career with a potential career in higher education, specifically in the realm of college sports. And on the advice of one of my mentors, applied for an internship at the NCAA National Office. Fortunately, was able to get into that internship program, spent 10 months at the National Office, really seeing from the inside out how the governance and membership service operations at the NCAA's headquarters really fueled the 1,000-plus member institutions and conferences to be able to do the things that they wanted to do, mainly help athletes find out what they want to do and put them on a path to get there, be it the Olympics, be it professional athletes, or like me, finding a career and actually being able to do something you're passionate about. I moved from the membership side after my internship internship experience was coming to the end, or sorry, from the national office side to the membership side, and went back to my alma mater. I worked as a compliance officer in the athletic department there for about 4 years. I did the same at the University of Maryland with the Terps as we were moving into the Big Ten Conference, which was a very enlightening time. And along the way, I realized that I really loved the rules education part of compliance, that I didn't necessarily enjoy the other parts of the job that were definitely a requirement, mainly the monitoring and the enforcement of the athletes and the coaches and existing in the rules structure, not from a helpful way, but from an adversarial way. And while I was on campus in Cincinnati, started teaching a class on sport law, and enjoyed it so much, I said, why don't I just do education all the time? Made a transition and wound up at the first and best sports administration program in the world at Ohio University. And I've been here, this is now my 8th year teaching.
Oh, that's amazing. Real quick, Brandon, do you have a piece of paper by your mic?
I do not.
Or something?
No paper, just the clothing. Is that too close? I can take the mic.
No, it sounded like you were crumbling something.
Oh, that was hard. Weird. It may be just me playing with my shirt.
Oh, is it rubbing on your shirt? Is that why the mic?
That could be it. Let me then.
Okay.
Hopefully, move the mic then away from the shirt. Hopefully, that helps.
I'll try to set up the mic. Where's the mic? Is it on that white thing on your right, by your right ear?
Yes. Yeah. So maybe it's rubbing against my beard.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay. All right. hopefully I can do some audio editing. I'm not really that great at this stuff, but I'll try to figure out something. Okay. All right.
Feel free to embarrass me for my microphone issues. That's fine.
No, thank you for sharing that, Brandon. Now, you were recently at the Culture and Sports' Annual Leadership Summit in a panel called Yes, There Will Be Lawyers. Can you share a little bit about what you talked about there and why that topic was important for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So given my background in college athletics, and I'm in the fortunate position where I am now, having seen both sides of this kind of new revolution of college athletics, not only as an athlete and administrator, but now on the other side as a faculty member, occupying those roles, I think has given me a multitude of opportunity to understand how college athletics is so unique and so important within American society, how it's developed historically into the giant organization that it is, and also the immense amount of bureaucratic issues that come when you have a structure that the NCAA has. It's very organic in that way, which is impressive, and it makes it a fun story to learn about and research, but also given its dramatic, over the past 40, 50 years, dramatic rise into a multi-billion dollar business. It is highly eligible, and it's also responsible, I think I would say, for society to critique it, because not every athlete has an experience like I did, and even for the revenue-producing athletes, not every experience is the same. So understanding that if you're going to support a structure that has, what do they say, 450,000 student athletes, you're not going to get it right, but can you at least, at a minimum, get it right for the people who are central to the mission, that being the athletes themselves. As an athlete, I had perspectives on NCAA legislation. I wasn't the most active student athlete, quite frankly, when it came to governance issues, which is ironic given, my career choice. But then certainly as an NCAA administrator and understanding, from the inside how perspective and biases are there as well, understanding that that organization as the NCAA itself is not the NCAA that we talk about. It's a bunch of individuals that show up and go to work and just do their job in terms of membership service. But then also getting out into the membership and understanding, okay, here's where many of these ideas about the rules originate or are perpetuated. And even though many of them you're tacitly kind of brought into, you also see from that perspective, okay, if you want to change the rules, it's going to affect this, this, and this. Are you prepared, national media? Are you prepared, professional athletic organizations? Are you prepared, fans out there in the world, critics of the organization, to deal with the fallout and the consequences of making some of those changes? And then certainly from my perspective now as an academic, and my challenge is not necessarily in this role to support everything that the NCAA does, but really think critically as to how can this organization be better? And my role, thinking with that and all the experiences that I've had, and my, you know, biases and my opinions about the NCAA have definitely formulated into something different than they were when I was an 18-year-old kid. So with all that being said, kind of as prologue, it's an exciting time, quite frankly, to be studying the NCAA and being on the outside of it, because I've got no skin really in the game at this point. I have athletes that are students. I've got a wife who works in the compliance office for a major athletic department, and then certainly I've got children who may be in the NCAA structure in the next year, in the next 5 years or so. So it does affect me, but it gives me, at least in my role, a little bit of perspective where I can look at things like the revolution of what's going on right now within college athletics and think about, okay, if you were back in the shoes of the role of a compliance officer or an athletic director, what would you say, what would you want to impart? And right now, you know, quite frankly, and what we talked about in the session was, if you're going to continue to try to perpetuate this model of intercollegiate athletics that you built, that you've been grappling with for 100 years, at some point you've got to kind of wave the white flag and say, all right, we realize that we no longer have the court system to support our main arguments for an antitrust exemption. And if that's not going to happen, every single limit that we put on our revenue-producing sports, and by extension now on every single athlete, potentially, because many of the plaintiffs in these major cases are coming from Olympic sports, if we're going to relax the policy on name, image, and likeness, is it time to just accept the fact that these athletes are probably employees, should be treated as employees, and then the things that we want to accomplish as an organization, we can collectively bargain for. There's input from the management side, obviously. There's input now from the employee side, and we can come to at least a stable kind of future of what college athletics is looking like. So that's what I'm looking forward, essentially, to following, is at what point, because I think it's inevitable at this point, and I think in the back of my mind and everyone's mind, it's always been inevitable, that the old members of the Supreme Court are going to retire, unfortunately die off. They're going to be replaced with individuals who weren't raised in an era post-World War II where you really could, in your mind, see the theory that athletes are students first. That growing up watching them on every single cable station and TV, and then certainly the NCAA's structure, as they should, loves to celebrate their media contracts, but understanding that this is now a multi-billion dollar business, part and parcel across the entire spectrum of the Power Four and even beyond. Absolutely. I think the goals that the NCAA wants to accomplish are going to have to be, or at least the NCAA structure, are going to have to be manipulated through the collective bargaining process, and that by natural extension means they're going to have to say, we were wrong. The athletes are employees. We're now going to treat them as employees. We're going to pay for our mistakes, at least back to the athletes with 2016 with the settlement. But at least going forward, through the end of the settlement period, we've got a structure by which everyone gets a little bit of something. The athletes get paid. The conferences continue through the college football playoff system and through their own media contracts to bring in multi-million dollars of revenue. They pay a portion of that out to the athletes, and they still are able to build facilities on campus. They're still able to pay their coaches multi-million dollar contracts and bonuses, and of course the administrators are able to pay themselves. Those critiques largely have been the frustrations for me, old compliance officer, that you know, back in the membership days, groupthink may it be, bias it may be, or actual job satisfaction may it be, would make you say, every time a contract is signed within the football level that adds $1 million to an annual salary, that adds another bonus for academic or championship performances, that adds requirements to deal with boosters, who then the university is going to go out there and say, hey, we want you to help us build a new facility through this capital campaign. Every time you see that, it hurts your argument on campus that I know there are actual student athletes on campus. I was a student athlete when I was on campus. Now, I wasn't a revenue-producing student athlete, you know. In fact, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they only charged about $5 per ticket to get into a track meet, and most of the people were getting in for free thanks to complimentary admissions. Anyway, that I noticed, quite frankly, on a campus like the University of Cincinnati, 13,000 people in Fifth Third Arena, that people were paying large amounts of money not only to go to the arena and see that, but between the current concessions and the merchandise on campus, and certainly when we got into the Big East Conference now, playing on a Big Monday game and literally a million people in the country are watching it in the football stadium on campus, the amount of revenue that's just around you, and then being an alum of the institution and putting some of that revenue back into it, being asked to donate for capital campaigns, Absolutely, absolutely. This is a multi-billion-dollar business that runs and runs and runs on the backs of athletes. All that being said, can we figure out a way to support them more? Right, and it's a difficult proposition because there are historical markers against it. And you know, as much as I want to be from a lawyer's perspective, and it's an important thing for most lawyers to kind of blind their biases, put them to the side, and stick directly to the law. That's one of the great things I was taught in law school, was make it about the law, make it about the law. It can't just be about the law. There has to be historical context into it. And even in some of your stronger considerations about civil rights and social justice, those things took time in order to make the situation stable enough to going forward. I think revolutionary change is happening, but I don't think it's going to happen all that quickly. And I do think you're going to have some strong, strong pushback from the administrators who eventually are going to have to say, hey, going forward, let's get rid of this amateurism model. In fact, the NCAA striked that out of their manual a couple years back and replaced it with the student-athlete model. If it's the college student model that you want to set up, okay, that's completely fine. We violate antitrust law in the sports world all the time. We have monopolies, we have monopsonies, we have labor agreements that restrict the fair market value of professional services. Like, we have those things. They're just collectively bargained for, so they meet exemptions to the law, where the law and the rest of the country just has to say, okay, that's the way you do it. Everyone agrees, that's fine. Have fun going forward. You know, the big question is, what does that look like? You can't know till you actually ask the athletes.
Right, exactly. No, you used a lot in what you were previously just talking about. You used the identifier we. Who is we within the college sports landscape?
And sports are funny that way, you know, where the identifying markers allow you to use language like, oh, hey, Cincinnati's got a big game coming up this weekend. Ohio's got a big game coming up this weekend. And if we're victorious, we can say, oh, you know, hey, I didn't play in the game, but we did really, really well. It's interesting like that. And the NCAA administrative structure is kind of the same way. I think your question is a fantastic one, because it really makes you think and consider not only the psychological factors and sociological factors by using that terminology, but also the responsibility and the, college sports is just unique, right? I think because of the consideration that, you know, many of the consumers are so attached to organizations because they went there. They're attached to organizations because there's more of them. So in a place like Columbus, Ohio, where I live, you know, professional sports-wise, you can be a Browns fan or you can be a Cincinnati Reds fan. You can, you know, pick and kind of choose. There's enough geographical room between all of the teams within the professional sports structure that you can kind of move in and out of the social spaces. But because there's, you know, a college town here and a college town there, people geographically are very, very attached to the local institutions, especially mm-hmm. when they do well. And Columbus is a perfect example of that. I would guess they have a couple hundred thousand living alumni, but they've got millions and millions of fans of the football program. So most of the people that support the institution, most of the people that drive into the revenue generation of the institution, don't have an actual economic connection to the institution itself, that they're just really, really big fans of the collegiate model. And I do think that's important to consider going forward. There is certainly the argument that, you know, no matter what happens going forward with sports, people are going to watch college sports, and I absolutely do believe that. I personally feel that we aspect is an important part of it. Not empirical, only anecdotal, but I would say the connection to your college teams in a sport like football are stronger than those connections to the professional sport. And of course, that's mm-hmm. not monolithic. It's not going to be the same. I happen to enjoy watching the NFL more than I do college football, but when a Bearcat game or an Ohio Bobcat game comes on, I'm locked in. And I'm locked in the ways that I'm not when a Cincinnati Bengals game comes on, because I do connect more closely, I would say, with the college athlete, maybe from my experience, than I do with the professional athlete. I do connect more closely with the institution that is providing multiple opportunities across multiple sports and across multiple academic disciplines than I do with a revenue-producing organization, a billion-dollar organization
right.
like the NFL. So I do think that we aspect of it, a long roundabout way to get to your answer, is built historically, that has to be put into consideration about what the model's going to look like going forward. But to say we, and I think it's important to point out that when people criticize the NCAA, oftentimes they're criticizing that institution that they love so much, right? You're a huge Buckeye fan, that's fantastic, but Ohio State flexes through the Big Ten Conference and individually its political power when coming up with and reinforcing some of these rules. That the Ohio States of the world, if you want athletes to get paid, are the ones most apt and able to do it. But a lot of their monies are, a lot of their expenses are tied up in, not to put the scholarships aside, because that's the largest portion of it, but even putting the college scholarships aside, a lot of their money's tied up in the employees working for the athletic department, as well as the facilities that they build, as with any other organization. Like, the money is probably there, but those institutions can often escape liability and responsibility for not spreading around the wealth because of that we factor. So I think the we, honestly, and not to, to give you a cop-out answer, I think it's everyone involved as a constituent of college sports, be it the major administrators, be it President Charlie Baker up at the NCAA National Office, be it the media members and the individual media organizations that are so influential with the conference alignment and time slots for competition, the coaches, obviously, themselves, from the top earning coaches all the way down to the most hardest working but not paid at all volunteer coaches, to the fan base, to the critics. Everyone, I think, is involved from that we aspect of the NCAA, and I do believe that demarcation, at least socially and historically within the United States, is one reason why I hope that we have a model of college athletics, college sports, that is different, separate from professional sports. I know some people don't want that. I know some people have very, very strong academic and legal arguments against that. But I do think, because we have a system of law within the United States that gives us the flexibility for industries and markets to kind of decide, in some cases, what they want to do, that I do hope that college sports is more of that we kind of organization as opposed to me organization based off consumption, right, as opposed to participation and enjoyment.
Right. No, thank you for sharing that. So where the power is in the NCAA, is it the 500,000 give or take athletes? Is it coaches and athletic directors? Is it you know, 1,000 member institutions? Is it the NCAA proper? Or is it the conferences? Is it the media? Who really controls the power in the NCAA? Because the NCAA themselves isn't going to pay out athletes at the institutions.
At least somewhat. I think they are tipping into some of their reserves. But the vast majority, yeah, you're correct.
So who is really... not only potentially paying the bill, but who really controls the power from your view in the NCAA?
So since this is sports, if we could do like a power rankings almost in terms of political power, because it's fascinating to me. I mean, I'm a political science academic, technically, I guess I would say. I got a political science degree. I'm a political junkie, absolutely. I follow along, and one of the most fascinating things working inside the membership in my particular area, the governance department, was seeing exactly how the political power is spread out across the NCAA structure, how they get together. I mean, that literally was my job, was getting organizations, the committees and cabinets and board of directors and governors into the room themselves and watching them do their business. So if I was going to do a power rankings, let's say, this is changing much like any good power rankings. This is dynamic based on recent events. You know, previously I would have put the CEOs of the institutions up at the top, and they're certainly up there. But I would think at this point right now, your major deciders are the athletic directors themselves. I'll give them the number one spot. If they're 1A, if they're the Chiefs, then I would say the Vikings are probably the conference commissioners, right? Because okay. I've seen development-wise, and you're seeing this even at the structure that the NCAA has, they're setting it up like this. The athletic directors themselves, in terms of their backgrounds, the old quick path to an athletic director chair was development. Raise money, raise money, raise money. We need more money, we need more money, because we have to pay the coaches, or otherwise they're going to go to pro level. And then we got to build facilities on campus so those coaches can actually go out there and recruit. And of course, we got to pay the athletes with scholarships, but that's usually easy to do because, you know, if I'm giving money and you convince me, hey, this is going to help somebody have a full ride to school, I'm a little bit more inclined, at least personally, to shell out that money as opposed to, well, this building that hopefully gets built in the next 5 to 10 years is going to be really cool when we actually build it. Or this coach that's probably going to leave here in 3 years, let's pay him or her now and raise the profile so we can have a new coach. No, those personal connections I think are great. But I've seen, you know, quite frankly, that more and more athletic directors are not necessarily following that old traditional path and are coming more from a revenue generation path on the media side. So I think you've got to consider absolutely the athletic directors as the front gates up there. The conference commissioners coming more and more from media backgrounds or having media trainings in that number two spot. The networks certainly flash a great amount of influence, but they're not necessarily in the room, and they kind of have to, crude way of putting it, but get the conference commissioners and athletic directors to kind of do their bidding. So I'd put them maybe in the third slot. The CEOs are still important, but any person that follows along with higher education probably understands, and I've got personal experience with this, how little of a job a president actually spend a little of the time a president on a campus actually spends worrying and dealing with athletics. They got so many other things going on, and that's why you hire, and traditionally why the athletic director role developed was to take that off of the president's plate so that that person can do what they do for the actual main campus, and that siloed department, much like a dean of a college, is taken care of by somebody with that individual expertise. But they're certainly important. Let's see, who are we leaving out? National media critics, maybe even there. And then finally, you get to the 500,000 plus athletes, the labor force itself. And I say that not necessarily with critique of their strategies, but internally, you've got some dynamics there. A football player at the University of Alabama is not going to have the same experience as a swimming and diving athlete at Ohio University. It just is what it is. And much like the professional unions, I mean, even within the NFL, you've got discord. And that discord has been taken advantage of by management. So if you want to give me the power structure on the, or if we want to do the power ranking structure of political power within the NFL, I mean, it's the owners way up here, and it's the players way down here, because there's so much discord within the labor force itself.
Right.
You've got Patrick Mahomes making $50 million, but then the minimum salary there is what? Somewhere close to $800,000 or something like that. Long career for Patrick Mahomes, short career for your average player that's making that minimum salary. That's going to cause discord. And we've got that, I think, within the student-athlete structure. There are student-athletes I know on campus who are looking at this opportunity of name, image, and likeness permission and are looking at the future of being paid and probably saying, hey, can we just keep it the way that it is?
Mm-hmm.
The other athletes, on the other hand, are filing lawsuits, and they have successfully, with each of these decisions over the past decade, chipped away at that model of amateurism. It sounds like very, very soon that those cracks within the statue of amateurism are going to lead the entire thing to come down. So I reserve the right to take the athletes and move them up those power rankings. But at least for right now, within the individual structure, they get, what, 2 votes? At the Board of Governors meeting, or three, I think at least 2 votes at
a 20 person. Out of too many votes.
Yeah, so I've been in those rooms, and I give credit to administrators and to faculty members and to conference commissioners and to presidents on campus, because they really do value the opinion of the athlete. It's just not always that the opinion of the athlete is representative of a body that makes up 500,000 people.
Right.
Even now, with a vote that they've been given over the past 10 years to sit in the room and actually vote on legislation, it is completely politically drowned out by the actual decision makers that every single day, that's what they're doing for their job, as opposed to the athlete that is going to school and working on their craft or their sport and has, you know, an hour or two a week that they spend on actual student athlete advisory committee issues or actual political issues, or actually being able to consume, you know, the information that's coming in from the networks or from the conference commissioners. The structure that we have now, while politically crafty, and I have to give, you know, some respect to that, they've given the athletes a voice and a vote, but in a way that maintains the old system of power. Collective bargaining, of course, will change that.
No, that was a great answer to a question that I honestly think a lot of people aren't really seeing, right? You know, they're like, oh, well, these athletes are getting all these benefits now. But are the athletes actually getting the benefits? Do the athletes, you know, sway what's currently happening? You know, and maybe the power dynamic is shifting, right? Or, I mean, it is shifting, you know, otherwise everything would still be status quo. So, you know, I think it's interesting to see that the percentage of ownership or percentage of being a stakeholder is changing a little bit in the college landscape, and change it, even though change is hard to embrace and a lot of people struggle with change. Change is normally always good. So it'll be interesting to see what continues to change and what continues to happen within the sphere. One of the things that you brought up earlier was, you know, at some point, you know, the NCAA needs to say, oh, they were wrong and they need to change the way how they're doing things. I could see potentially the NCAA paying out money, but I really struggle to think that the NCAA would actually say they were wrong, you know, even if all the courts tell them they're wrong. Like, do you believe with your time at the NCAA and just your time within the college sports landscape that NCAA would actually apologize and say they were wrong? You know, because you understand a little bit more because you're a political, you know, you're politically focused a little bit, that, you know, humans, it's hard for them to apologize and admit wrongdoing. Do you think the NCAA would openly admit it, or do you think they would just pay out money in lieu of admitting that they were wrong?
Nothing says sorry like money. Right, so that's as simple as I can make it. Nothing says sorry.
Okay.
So to your point, no, I don't think they'll come out and say we were wrong. I think they're still going to continually to actively pursue an antitrust exemption. And I don't know how much of that is, you know, we don't want to admit we're wrong versus this is just going to solve our problems legally. But no, I don't think they'll say sorry. I do think they'll have to pay up, and it looks like they're willing to do that. And I think it's been a very pointed strategy. You know, as we're talking about these power rankings, as we're talking about, you know, traditional paths to leadership, the diminished role within the NCAA governance structure of the president, I think, has been helpful, right? Because and it would be a bad idea for me to slander, you know, institutional CEOs and administration, mm-hmm. You know, quite frankly, but they're... Because they're so minimally focused on athletics, it's necessarily, it shouldn't be a part of any president's job major to focus on athletics. It's of course important one. It's a multi-billion dollar, you know, potential windfall to the organizations themselves, but they shouldn't be focusing on it. So a lot of times they can be convinced very, very easily of this system is the way it should be because mm-hmm. we've always done it this way.
Right.
So I think many of the voices right now would be beholden, I guess I would say, to that philosophy and wouldn't want to say we're wrong here. They would just want to say the courts are making us do this. And that's completely fine. You know, if you're the athletes and you want an apology, you can certainly ask for that through settlements, whatever that apology would look like. You know, it's not just money. But it could be an injunction, you know, forcing somebody to do something or forcing them to refrain from doing something. But I think the key here and the reason why athletes are being approached by lawyers, you know, quite frankly,
right.
Is to put the money in the pocket. Is that what I want for the future of college sports? Maybe me, not personally, but I can't look at the head coach salaries. I can't look at the capital projects on campus and say, you know what, I see a pathway forward where college athletics can resemble what it is now. We're past that. It's already
right.
done. Every time you step into a multi-million dollar, probably very soon, multi-billion dollar renovated facility, every time you see 110,000 paying customers, every time you look at the secondary market and to get into a game, it's $200, $300. Every time you go to the college football playoff, you're going to be reminded of the fact that the old way just can't be the new way. It's not possible. There's no going back. You've already fractured the relationship so greatly, and now you actually have the support of the federal court system within it, that there's no way that you'll ever be able to say, hey, we are sorry. we did it the wrong way. Can we come to an agreement that's going to be good for both of us and for the entire Wii system of college sports within the North American structure? It's not going to be the case. Eventually, maybe it's like the court system. Eventually, maybe some of the leaders retire. Maybe some of them go into other industries because they're afraid of the new frontier. Maybe some of them, you know, unfortunately, like I mentioned, die off. That, you know, that happens, and that's been instrumental for changes to professional sports as well, unfortunately. But I think it's going to take a new frontier of administrators, maybe many of them coming from this NIL structure themselves, that are there to say, you know what, apologies are fine, we'll give them to you, but let's focus on the future of the enterprise. Let's focus on the business itself. To put it to a point in the term, nothing says sorry like money.
Right, exactly. Now, people are creative. You know, humans adapt. You know, we have great ideas. You know, some are actually good and some are definitely not. Do you think at any point, because money talks and money is their primary driver and they're the ones who carry the power, just money, do you think that through all of these lawsuits and antitrust and everything else, that a new model within college sports may emerge, or that the NCAA as we know it kind of fades in the background and maybe it's back to like a conference-based system? And do you think if something like that were to happen, that a lot of the dynamics of these lawsuits would actually change? Because I noticed a lot of the lawsuits are kind of attacking the overall integrity of the NCAA and just the way things have been going, right? But if all of a sudden it's decentralized, do you think that, for one, that might actually happen where it becomes more of a decentralized model? And two, what do you think the impact of that would be?
I like to say this. Even if there's no NCAA, there will always be an NCAA. The
right.
The reason I say that is because, again, if you look at the rules in that 400-page Division I manual, they were all put in there by schools that make up the NCAA. In fact, the schools that right now, people always say, hey, let's blow up the NCAA. Let's create a fourth division. And, you know, my critique of that is, okay, but the schools that you want in that fourth division, the schools that you want to be removed from the NCAA system are the ones that put those restrictions in the first place. Some of those restrictions are going to have to go by the wayside. Some of those restrictions, many of them might have to be collectively bargained one day. But at the end of the day, the athletes are not going to get on the field without the administrative structure. It is what it is. You need an athletic director. And in fact, many of the athletes, quite frankly, that benefit from that administrative structure, you know, if you're a college athlete right now, you're not getting paid for your sport. A scholarship is your form of payment, I guess I would say, but it's capped. You're not getting paid in a fair open market, but you are getting plenty of benefits. You are getting in-kind benefits. And even though, you know, money is green, the amount of in-kind benefits that allows an individual on campus, for example, at one of these major football teams to focus on the ability to present yourself to a potential NFL team and be drafted, so many things are taken care of in terms of your academic pursuits. So many things are taken care of in terms of your medical pursuits. So many things are taken care of in terms of insurance and things that you don't have to worry about. Paying your rent in some cases because you've got off-campus housing that's taken care of. Paying for your car note, to finding places to park on campus, getting parking tickets taken care of, massaging the structure of a campus, a higher education environment. Administrators take care of that. And if I'm an athlete, you know, quite frankly, and I can focus on my craft, like many professional athletes do, if somebody can take care of that, fine. All right, if that's the case, you're going to have to make some concessions then in terms of how much you're actually getting paid. So I don't think it, and again, I'm hopeful about this. I don't know for sure, because there could be a court that decides at the counter, or there could be a settlement. But I'm of the opinion that whatever goes forward is going to look remarkably similar to the NCAA itself. It might not be the NCAA as we know it. And I'm concerned as an Olympic sport athlete, a former Olympic sport athlete, what's going to happen to the, 86 other sports. Maybe round down to 80. I'm concerned what happens with 80 other sports. Are they going to drop down to club level? Is there going to be an NCAA that administers the championships? Is there going to be an NCAA that makes sure that player mental and physical safety is at the priority? And those are the two things, you know, that I think going forward, that quite honestly, nobody can really criticize. The NCAA does two things very well, and they've always done these well, in my opinion. In fact, the original two reasons the organization got started. Let's take care of the players and make sure that they're mentally and physically safe, and I think they do a remarkably good job at that, despite some criticisms, and decide who the national champion is. Mm-hmm. Right? that's what I think our understanding of the NCAA is going to be going forward. And then the critiques that we have about the NCAA itself, the government's critiques, initial eligibility, continuing eligibility, graduation, recruiting, coaching salaries, coaching staff members, all of those will get shifted to the conferences. I can see that very much. And then the conferences will have to figure out, okay, who's in our group? And maybe they'll call it, a division, right? Here's Division One, and then underneath that, maybe Division Two, Division Three, Division Four. It's going to look remarkably similar to what we have now, and I think that's just a result of the political process where administrators have to have the flexibility to do what they do to help the athletes do what they do. And there has to be a symbiotic relationship there where we as administrators are helping you at your craft by taking care of a lot of things that you're doing it, and in exchange, you allow us to support maybe the most important role within the governance structure. And here's one I left out of my power rankings, the coaches themselves, right? These rules are in place because coaches are very opinionated about how they do their jobs. That's probably the softest way that I can say it, but yeah, leaving the coaches out of there was probably a mistake, because at the root of all the rules within that rule book is a coach raising their hand and saying, I can't win unless the rule's like this.
Right.
And that's always going to be the case, in my opinion. If you're paying a coach $10 million to coach a football team, the athletes are going to listen to that person, because that person can help them get to the next level. The administrators are going to listen to that person, because I'm paying you more than I'm making in order to put the product on the field. And when you do well, my perception and public profile has a positive connotation of that. So at central to this absolutely is the coaches. And as long as the coaches are looking around at each other and are distrustful of each other, they're going to put rules in place, or they're going to have the administrators, because this is a genius thing of the coaches. They get these coaches' associations together, and then they go back to their campuses and their conferences, and they're like, hey, go suggest this rule because so-and-so is cheating. And everybody knows that person's cheating, and now let's put in a rule so that they can stop cheating.
Right.
You're going to have that. You're going to have rules in a rule book, and the Big Ten SEC Alliance, and it's going to look exactly what it looks like right now. You're going to have a big-ass rule book. Sorry, I don't know if I'm going to cuss. Sorry. You're going to have a big rule book.
No, go for it.
And if you're going to have a rule book, any rules enforcement process has to have rules, and then people looking at the rules, and then an enforcement mechanism. And that's what we have in the NCAA structure that's got them in so much trouble right now. The rules themselves are the ones that are often attacked with the lawsuits. Fans get upset when enforcement gets in your stuff and comes to campus and starts making investigations, because now your rivals can start talking trash about you. And then there's got to be an enforcement component, whether it be an extreme enforcement component like the death penalty applied to SMU back in 1987, or whether it be an 8-year show cause for a coach that had to go to the NFL because they won't be able to coach in the NFL structure. You're going to have a remarkably similar system, in my opinion, to what we have right now. But the critiques, and most critically right now, the lawsuits are not going to be there, because the athletes are going to have a say in the process.
Right, right.
And that's probably, just to finish the point, sorry,
for
cutting you
off. No, go
for it.
Just
to finish the point, that's probably the most frustrating, and I don't know if irony is the right word. In fact, it probably is. It's probably the most ironic thing that's going on right now. The coaches and the administrators can probably get what they want as long as they take a piece of their profits and give it to the athletes. And the athletes, quite frankly, in my opinion, would probably just say, okay, whatever, fine, that's good. I'm getting paid. Like many people, like adults in societies, like professionals, you pay me money, I digest the rules and the penalties for violating those rules a little bit better than when I don't have input and I'm not getting paid.
No, that's a very interesting way to put it. And thanks for sharing all of that. Now, when do you think that the major changes will happen within college sports in general? Do you think that it's already happened? Do you think that there's a huge change to come? Where do you think the breaking point is on when that change will actually happen? And what will that change be?
Yeah, not to get, I don't want to get too civics-y into it. But political and legal change in this country takes a while, right? We're 52 years into Title IX, and there's been some remarkable and substantial changes within that, and there's also been pushback and conversations about, do we still need the law? Does the law work the way that it is? Does Congress really need to have the authority through the Department of Education to be giving regulations? Hell, there's even conversation right now, do we need a Department of Education, right? So even 52 years into Title IX, we're still grappling and struggling with applying that very important piece of legislation on the board. It took, 30-some years of legislative activity and court cases from 1954 to make Brown versus Board of Education an actual reality for school segregation. Mm-hmm. And even in 2003, we've got a case where we're still trying to desegregate schools. And I'm seeing statistics all the time that school segregation is still an issue across the country. So we're 70 years after that, right? We've got 100 plus years of antitrust law activity. And even in many cases, that, you know, it's impressive that law has been in place for 100 and, you know, plus years. But we're still having issues with antitrust right now within this country between right. The cases against Google or the cases against the NCAA. So it takes time for court decisions to actually find their way from the bench to the impact on the actual ground itself. Right. Having said all that, college sports are probably different. Because sports are different within this country. And within the context of antitrust law, like one of the things I ask in my sport law class is, how do we get away with the NFL being a monopoly? How do we get away with the NBA being a monopoly? They're not legislated monopolies like the United States Postal Service or anything like that. Like, they operate as monopolies because sports are different. And I love
the fact that... But isn't that the NCAA's whole argument? Is that they're different and they're not applicable to antitrust?
Maybe it should be, right? Their old argument was education. They're not employees because sports are not our prime business. Education is our prime business. So, yeah, we'll pay the work-study graduate student, but we won't pay the athlete because at least that's our core business over there. Sports are just, they're different in this country, and it kind of is what it is from that aspect of it, because there's nothing individually that I can do to change it. And when you put us all sports fans together collectively, none of us are going to raise our hands and be like, yeah, I want my sports different. Like, we like the status quo. We like what it is. Mm-hmm. So as much as I would love to say that this is going to be a 2-year to 10-year kind of process, which looks like the timeline for the settlement, they'll make the settlement. Hopefully it gets approved sometime in early April. About a year later or so, the payments will hopefully be out to everybody, and then you'll have a governance system in place that took those settlement parameters and put them into the rule book or put them outside the rule book or whatever it is. And then this agreement will last for 10 years, so you've got that flexibility. I imagine, based on historical, legal, and social parameters around something like that, when a single judge or a panel of 9 judges gets involved and tells the country what to do, but has no real force behind doing it, right? And we can imagine, yet not to get again civically too civic in it, but when the Supreme Court makes a decision, what's stopping us from violating that decision?
Right.
And that's probably a dangerous question to ask, you know, on a podcast that people will be watching, but the same thing goes for a federal court. When a federal court makes a decision, you know, really at the end of the day, what's stopping individuals within a business or within an industry from violating that decision? We do it all the time, right? And right. I think you're still going to have repeat violators of this new system and new frontier of college athletics that's going to delay that process of what the new NCAA looks like, probably at least if we refer to a 4 to 5 year cycle as a generation of athletes, probably 3 generations of athletes. It's going to be maybe my kids that get the benefit of whatever this new system is, and everything in between is going to be an ad hoc kind of way of, much like the interim policy of July 2021, the board of directors just saying, hey, you can do NIL right now. Okay, well, what about bylaw 12.5.1, which says we can't? Leave it in the rule book. That's completely fine. Here's an exception that says you can do it, and now you've got two complete, literally competing pieces of legislation within the structure. And if I'm a compliance officer on campus, I'm looking at one, I'm looking at the other, and I'm trying to figure out how the hell can I actually do my job. We're in limbo. We're in the wild, wild west right now, particularly when it comes to name, image, and likeness being used as a tool for recruiting. And I think that's going to be the case for the next 10 to 12 years. I might be wrong about that, but I imagine that's probably going to be your time frame. I think that's long enough for the current administrators to, you know, retire and ride off into the sunset, and some of them are. I think that's enough time for the administrators that grew up within the structure to start changing their minds and accepting the new philosophies, and I certainly think that's enough time for the athletes, because many NCAA administrators and even a decent number of college CEOs are coming from the athlete experience. So for those athletes mm-hmm. that are part of the experience right now and are able to earn money from their name, image, and likeness, and very soon some of them might be paid by their institution to license their NIL, by the time they get to leadership positions 10 right. to 12 years down the road, they're going to be the ones that say, you know what, damn the court system, let's just do it ourselves.
Right, exactly, exactly. So one of the things we do on the Culture and Sports Podcast is we give the guests the last word. So with that said, thank you so much for coming on today and for sharing your expertise and your knowledge and just your excitement about collegiate sports in general. So thank you for that, Brandon. I really do appreciate it. But before we sign off for the day, if there's anything you could say to athletes, coaches, support staff, athletic directors, colleges, universities, conferences, the NCAA, the media, all those who control the dollars and the politics, what is it that you would say to any or all of them?
Well, I would first say thank you, Jeremy. This conversation was fun. I had a lot of fun with it. Your questions and contributions to the conversation make it very easy to get the thoughts out. So I appreciate the forum and the opportunity to participate.
Thank you.
But I would say... figure it out, I guess I would say. Like, as easy, as simple as it sounds, if we let the court systems, and I say there's that we again, but if we let the court systems dictate what college sports is going to look like, because it's so unique globally and it's so unique domestically, if we let the courts get involved, even as a lawyer myself, I'm not sure what that future is going to look like. I know eventually it's going to get to a place, if we let the courts get involved, where there is collective bargaining, and it's going to look more like professional sports. I don't know if I necessarily want that in my college sports. Maybe it's I'm afraid of what something else might look like. But you've got the opportunity now here within the NCAA structure to get together with the athletes and come to some form of consensus. And maybe that's a collective bargaining agreement itself, but instead of waiting for a settlement, instead of waiting for a Supreme Court decision, whatever the next one might be, because they've already sent warning shots about that, instead of waiting for antitrust exemptions coming from Congress, can you just figure it out on your own? It's a difficult proposition, and it requires the collective activity of a lot of working parts and a large number of people. But if you are really interested in saving the concept of college sports, and by college sports, it's important to get the definition out there, meaning that you've got athletes that are students of the institution that are competing with peer institutions on an annual basis in a set number of sports. If we want that to be the model going forward, then just figure it out. Because I think,
right,
and I might be right about this, regardless of your opinion about it, regardless of the legal parameters involved, if you were just asked people within that we of the NCAA, of intercollegiate athletics, I think a lot of them would agree with that statement. I like that aspect of it. I like it going forward. It says nothing about amateurism. It says nothing about not paying the athletes. It says nothing about not paying college coaches more than the president or the athletic director on campus. But it just says, if this is our framework, a very, very simple framework, and we want to keep that intact, then figure out a way to make that happen. The athletes are clearly upset, and they're being advised for the first time for some very, very smart individuals that have been change makers within professional sports and other industries as well. They're not going to stop there. The administrators themselves are so upset from getting their butts kicked in court that now they're changing the way we even hire administrators, and we're getting people from professional sports that are coming in and trying to make it look more like professional sports. The media networks themselves understand the immense power that they have, but even they're over-leveraged because they're spending way too much money on the product, and they might not be happy going forward. So if everyone is outside of the circle, not necessarily happy with where they are, can we get back inside the circle and start talking about the things we have in common, the things that we agree, and figure it out so that we don't need the court systems, we don't need the United States Congress, and we don't need the president of the country to come in and let us know how it should be done, that we, like many industries in a free market society, are able to figure it out on our own.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about culture and sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture and Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.